Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile. With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. I bet you get 30, 30, I bet you get 30, I bet you get 20, 20, 20, I bet you get 20, 20, I bet you get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month, sold.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Hello, my name's Gary and I'm from Nebworth and you're listening to Dame Pat Tease Questions Everything. My question is, who's better, Jamie Vardy or Harry Kane? Well, here comes the show, and remember to question everything.
Hello, everybody, and welcome to Dame Baptiste Questions Everything, a podcast with myself, comedian, writer, and occasional actor Dame Baptiste. My producer friend, Howard Cohen, a.k.a. The Hizzer.
Hello.
Pose the questions that need to be asked, and we are talking everything from...
Where's it gone? No, it is Gary from Nebworth's question. Who is better, Jamie Vardy or Harry Kane? Football-based for you there, Dane.
I mean, neither of those people play for Arsenal, so who cares, Howard? Who cares?
Thank you. Yeah.
No, I would say... well, that's a tough one. I'm not really like to compare, but I guess I am probably more ensconced with Jamie Vardy's rise from non-league football to league.
Oh, it's a great story. It's a great story.
So it's like a nice little football scenario story. That being said, you know, Harry Kane seems like a great guy as well. So yeah. I guess, you know, you can have two strikers up front, Gary. Don't have to choose all the time. Doesn't always have to be a singularity.
But as with this show every week, we ask and answer all the questions, don't we, Dave?
Absolutely. And no question is too stupid or too small. So if you like the show, please rate and review on Apple Podcasts or follow us on Spotify and you'll never miss an episode. Or subscribe to us on Acast, the world's largest podcast network. If you want to see the best and most diverse guests on any podcast anywhere in the world. That being said, today's very special guest is a radio and TV presenter, writer and true crime vlogger. For the last few years, her infectious energy has been delighting listeners on the airwaves of Capital Extra. Her TED Talk, The Myth of Escaping a Ghetto, helped her continued rise as an engaging public speaker. Her first two documentaries were the much heralded Love, Lies and Nudes and Music is the Answer. And her new documentary, Damiola, The Boy Next Door, is available to watch on Channel 4 in late 2020, very soon. Please welcome to the show the multi-talented, multifaceted Yinka Bokini. What's up, Yinka?
You are the first person to ever say my name correctly. You pronounce it
right. Yeah.
Look how surprised you are. Listen, you think Dane would be an easy thing, Yinka. One syllable, yeah? Struggled. Dave.
Do people call me Danny?
Danny. Uber drivers always call me Danny. It is for Danny. And I just go, yeah. Not actually sure. Anything, but I get Danny from Uber drivers, but mainly it was like Dave, Dwayne, Dale, Dane, Shine.
Child. It's got to the point now where I just call myself Bikini because it makes people, it's just what I say. I say Yinka Bikini, but Bokini is how my dad pronounces our name. So you hit it on the head there.
There you go. Well, I'm glad we do try to emphasize that.
I think people are lazy, aren't they? No, the people are lazy and they look at your surname and obviously it has some similarity with the word bikini. Mm-hmm. And therefore they just can't be bothered to actually look at the fact that there's an O which massively changes... and there's a double N, right? So it just changes a few bits, doesn't it?
Yeah, and also, it's one of those ones as well, though, that like, you know, I'm Yoruba, Nigerian, and our names are spelt phonetically. Just say the letters.
Super phonetically. Can. That's what makes it even crazier. Ancestrally, I'm Igbo. So I'm still trying to work that out. But yeah, it's really, not as in work out, as in like, in terms of like the more nuanced aspects of but yeah, man, I always try the best with the names. And if I got it wrong, I hope you'd say to me, that's not how you say it then.
I'm like, oh, so, go again.
Exactly. But how have you been, not just for this month, how's life so far? If you could take a snapshot, how's it going?
Yeah, you know, it's actually going really well. I know 2020, I think everybody who's been on your podcast probably said it's been a rough year and all that malarkey. For me, it's, you know, I was shielding for such a long time and now whilst working a little bit, it's very, very busy. It's good and... Obviously, I'm very grateful to be able to function in a world that's on fire. But yeah, it's really busy because I do breakfast at Capital Extra, innit? So I get up at like 4:30 every day. This is basically midnight for me.
Oh, yeah, it's true. Shout out to Shayna as well. Mm-hmm. So thanks for having me on the show. But, you know, I think it's cool you say as well, because I guess the one way of rationalizing what's happening right now for us is that we've had a relative amount of privilege to a lot of people in the world whereby this is a madness for us.
Yeah.
If you've been in Syria for the last 10 years or, you know, the Middle East, if I asked you how your year was and I was like, yeah, I couldn't really go out for a couple of months because they had to deliver the food to my house because I couldn't really go.
Yeah. So
they're going to be like, oh, that sounds tough. Just deliver her instead than having a knife and fork in a restaurant. So
no, that's true. And it's like, you know, whilst it has been definitely tumultuous, it's a privileged tumultuous.
Yeah. I mean, you have to find it, innit? You have to find it. I always say to people as well, it's like, you know, even when we opine on something, which is obviously a lot clear now in terms of Black Lives Matter as a humanitarian protest, it's like, trust me, it's bad. But the first, no, civil rights was never easy. There's no, like, if you were to ask people that did this in the beginning, much more difficult. So,
and they've been doing it for 20 years.
There you go. So it's a long time. Yeah. So, you know, if you're finding a way to thrive in this environment, that's supposed to be what the human spirit is supposed to do anyway. So business as usual, Yinka, you know how you do.
Today's episode is going to be a bit different, listeners, because we're going to do one of our kind of very focused episodes rather than the normal format of everyone asking a question. We're going to focus entirely on our guest's question, who has a very, very good question to throw at us.
My question, Howard and Dane, is why are we so fascinated with true crime?
Oh, and it's a subject that, you know what, a lot of our listeners will be true crime fanatics, but obviously it's, you know, there's kind of an obsession we have through television, right? But then also it's we've always been obsessed with true crime. It's the most popular bit of news in a way, isn't it? In a really weird way.
Actually, like, yeah, I think it's probably, and maybe that's one of the reasons why, is that it's one of the only instances whereby you can look at something factual, and it's a... can still appear very much stylized if you're detached from the event. But it's such a good point, because to be honest with you, it's like when I started doing a podcast, you're kind of like, well, I mean, we ain't really doing true crime numbers. So because, like, yeah, people have this real voyeuristic obsession with true crime. And you know, to see, and I see it in podcasts, a lot of popular and prevalent podcasts featuring true crime. I would argue that as well as just the volume of content, one of the reasons that Netflix has become so successful as a streaming site is that it's had a large focus on documentaries about true crime as well. And also, you could argue, you know, being that hip hop is the most influential music genre in the world, a large amount of their narrative focuses on chronicling true crimes committed by artists, or at least giving a journalistic account of crimes they may have witnessed. So, lots of fashion society. Are you a true crime fan, Yinka?
I am potentially the biggest true crime fan. Since I was a kid, though, like, even, you know, I'm talking when you're driving in the car and you're in the back and your mum's driving and you go past an accident and you're there staring out the window trying to catch a glimpse, you know, on the motorway before you zoom past. I mean, even the way that we document trials and the way that the media works and all of that, to the podcast and to the true crime documentaries and books. And I run my own true crime YouTube where I talk about bits and bobs that have happened as well. And honestly, at first I thought that it was just like, you know, like a British thing, that you know, we love a little crimes that shook Britain. But then I realized, especially we've got Serial, the podcast, and you've got, you know, I follow like loads of court kind of Twitters and that. It is a worldwide, you know, that's like, even if you look at the kind of like charity events that happen, a lot of them revolve around like crime. Look at Crime Watch, look at the numbers that did back in the 90s.
Yeah, America's Most Wanted was a massive phenomenon as well.
Cops.
To Catch a Predator.
Border
Force as well. Yep. Police Stop is another one as well.
Yeah, Yinka, what was the thing that got you hooked? Was there a particular thing that recently in the last kind of true crime?
Oh, I want to ask, before you answer that question, Yinka, who was your first, who's your favourite serial killer? Oh, is there...
Favourite?
You don't have a favourite? Because I think some people might...
No.
I've got a favourite. I can tell you who mine is very quickly. But anyway.
Who's your favourite, Howard?
Oh, the Zodiac is the fucking... That film is amazing, I think. And
the letter was so contrived, though.
That's what I was about to say, Howard. Why is he your favourite?
I just think that's an incredible thing to have done. He made it... He was like... social mediaing, murdering people in the 70s. It's like, I thought he was an incredible story. And also you got Mark Ruffalo, Robert Downey Jr. and Jake Gyllenhaal in one film.
That's really good, a great film. That is a great film. I think for me, my actual, one of my favourites and part of the reason why I've got into true crime recently, the story's a little bit intertwined. So I used to work in a pub and it was very boring, and I used to read a lot, and my mate got me a Kindle, and I kind of just like went through loads and loads of books and was just reading them, and it got to the point where I got a bit bored of stories, so I started reading non-fiction books. And there's a crime writer called Anne Rule, and she had written a book, and I hope I get the title right. I think it's called The Stranger Beside Me. I think that's what her book's called. And she used to work in a call centre with none other than Ted Bundy. That was her mate. He was a good friend. And he used to work on the Samaritans or the Suicide or something hotline. And she was his mate, like, as in she's like, yeah, Teddy, like the way she talks about him.
He's like, Carol from Accountant's a bitch. Someone should kill her, Ted, huh? yes, another biscuit.
And then when he like got caught and he's in prison, like, and all this stuff, he's ringing her like, oh, Anne, babes, it ain't me, like, honestly, they got the wrong guy. She's like, you're right, Ted. I know you. I've known you for years. And she's there on his side until she goes to court one day. And, you know, they're like, yeah, he might have eaten this person. And like, yeah, you know, he definitely like killed three people in one day. Because there's this one day, like one of his peak days of killing is that he, I think it was two women in a, it was like a Labor Day weekend or something like that in America. And there were thousands and thousands of people in the park. And imagine if us guys were having a nice little picnic at, by the lake. And I'm like, oh, I'm just going to go toilet. And I never return. And he did that twice in one day. Like he killed, took somebody, killed them, came back and did it again. And only when they're at court anyway, Anne was like, oh my God, my mate's a killer. Let me block his number still.
Yeah. In those days it was. Yeah,
that's how I got into true crime recently.
Oh, cool. So it's quite a recent thing for you.
Well, in the last like 5 years,
Okay.
I've always like enjoyed a little bit of Britain's Most Evil Killers on the Investigation Network and that, and I love a bit of Judge Judy.
But that's favorite show is Judge Judy. That's how much you love Discipline. I never catch him watching anything like saucy. It's like, ooh, Judge Judy just telling people they're stupid. I mean,
listen, Judy is a legend.
He is a real legend, to be fair.
but was there a serial killer you particularly loved, or a kind of true crime thing that particularly got you kind of hooked again, Yinka, or?
I think it was listening to Serial, the podcast, you know, because was that the first ever podcast? I don't know.
But it was the first true crime one that really got people sucked in.
Yeah, so that listening to that really made me think, oh, because I love reading and I like learning things. So that kind of like really enthralled me. And then it encouraged me to do my own research, and it encouraged me to like find out more and more and more. And with the rise and rise of podcasts over the last few years, there are some sick true crime ones that, you know, some of them are funny, some of them are really serious, some of them are a bit scary, some of them are short form, some of them are long form. I think I would say that one of the cases that for me really kind of piqued my interest in true crime of recent years, I think it's like, it was a podcast called The Teacher's Pet. It's out of like Australia. And I think it's hosted by a dude called Henley or something like that. And basically this woman, yeah, she went missing in like 1981. Yeah. One day her mum rang her. She's got two kids. She's like 29 or something. Yeah. She's married. Her mum's like, oh, you're right there. She's like, oh yeah, my husband made me a lovely drink. She's a bit sloshed. Yeah. Then she's never heard from again. Her name's Lynette. Her husband definitely killed her and put her under the pool. And like this podcast, it's like 10 episodes or something like that long. And But when he started it, the police weren't looking into anything. And as the podcast started growing and people in Australia started listening to it, the police reopened the investigation. My man, Chris Dawson's been arrested in the charges. And it's that thing of it really making a difference, because I think with true crime, for me, it's like the fascinating and horrific things people do to each other. It's the psychology behind it. But reporting on it and, you know, missing cases or unsolved cases and the person who has the interest in it making a difference, That's insane to me.
I mean, I was going to think, what aspect of the whole, I guess, paradigm of like true crime you enjoy the most? And is that a part of it? Is the fact that opening the cases actually causes cases to be reopened and investigated? Is that what done it for you?
I think also, like, I'm the annoying type of person who really struggles to understand when people are violent and people do horrible things to each other. It's weird because throughout my life, you know, I've grown up in areas that can be deemed as violent and I've experienced violence.
I get it. Can I say, because the reason why I ask about the favorite serial killer stuff is because I, after my first bad breakup, was when I started getting into serial killers. Which is probably a very extreme, and you might
have a bit. Yinka's gone. Like, Yinka just left the show now, is that?
I'm someone that likes to work, I like work things out. And I guess what were normally the typical reasons for a relationship ending, whether it's like infidelity or like, you know, aggression or insulting, wasn't really the reason. So I'm always kind of like, why would someone hurt somebody with no reason to do so? And then as you begin on that rabbit hole, and they said, it's more like looking at like heartbreak, and then that became looking at sociopathy, and then looking at like, being like a psychopath and stuff like that as well. So it was kind of like, what can cause somebody to have no love in their heart kind of thing? Which again, I said, dramatic. However,
no, but I hear you though. I see it.
You want to know at the quantum of like someone's emotional complex, what starts off to them to be like, I'm going to do something.
It's the age old argument. Like, are they bad or are they mad?
Exactly that.
It's so weird because, you know, I do consume a lot of true crime, and yes, you've got your extremely famous ones like the Ted Bundys and you know, the you've got the bomber guy and all this stuff. But even just down to like, you know, your everyday run-of-the-mill murder, right? It's like, for me, if somebody is deemed to be a psychopath, yeah, they're actually deemed to be bad. Yeah, so they're bad people. But it's like, are they not also a bit mad? Are they not also?
Well, that's the kind of biological argument for it, is that like people believe like, you know, being able to display empathy or care for another person, or even the just performative aspects of like what would be love or affection, they are supposed to begin in your brain with like chemical releases and forms and stuff like that. But if you grow up in an environment where you don't have any situation where you get to create those centers in your brain or stimulate those centers in your brain, as you get older, they don't really form. So exactly. You're not in a situation where anyone cares about you. You will not learn a concept of sympathy or empathy because you've not seen it before repeated. In the same way that, like, if you come from a broken home, you're more likely to end up in being divorced because you've not really seen the aesthetic of a stable family. So it's the same thing as that. It was kind of like, for example, the commonality I found when I was looking at true crime, more like serial killers, is that everyone had a very poor or strange relationship with their parents. So, yeah. You know, I don't know if it was Ted Bundy, but it might have been Ed Gein, where it was like, he killed prostitutes that looked like his mom.
That's Ed.
That's Ed, right? Yeah. So he'd killed the women that he'd kill would resemble his own mother. So a lot of the time, or even like, you know, the original film, like Psycho, is about Norman Bates' relationship with his mother and stuff as well. So.
Yeah, and even if you look at somebody like John Wayne Gacy, who, you know, was the clown.
The clown, yeah. That it's based on kind of.
Yeah, yeah, that and even the American Horror Story, I think it might be season 4, I think, or he's definitely in the hotel, where it was just that the nature of his victim was very telling of the underlying conditions that he had. But, you know, those are definitely the general rules. And you do have, you know, even be it the Unabomber who has these ideals and who they have their manifestos and their thoughts, and they're very much blinkered and driven.
Yeah.
But then you have other killers who are just kill their whole family, like Chris Watts, for instance. Mm-hmm. And that's like the new show on Netflix.
He just, man. I mean, and that's the thing as well, is would that be the, historically people describe it as crime of passion.
Mm.
But then what he did afterwards would argue is premeditated. So how do you go from being this doting father and husband to your emotions raised to the point where you commit an act of violence and to your family? But then after that happens, you're
looking for them.
Yeah, you don't look for them. Or your brain doesn't rationalize that, like, no. You know, you should be punished for your crime. Because if someone else had done that to your family, you'd want them to be punished. But it's like.
But the thing that also comes to mind for me, you know, just going back to the central question, why are we all so fascinated by it, right? Is I think it's just the fact that if you go back over a lot of culture, artistic culture, the whodunit is such a kind of old school thing, right? Like, I think, isn't it the first play that's still, I think it's still running, called the Mousetrap, that's been running. We're not running at the moment, but it's been running for, you know, centuries.
Yeah.
Is a whodunit. Whodunits, you know, Agatha Christie, Columbo. You know, remember all those shows, Murder, She Wrote?
Murders.
Right? Yeah.
Murder, She Wrote's the one for me. I mean, I remember just so all of that stuff we lived through and just accepted as a thing. And then you see, somehow we've, a younger generation has been connected to whodunits through these documentaries that are just so... I mean, I don't know, where do you guys stand on Making a Murderer? I know a lot of people who give that a lot of shit because it doesn't deliver a verdict.
It could have been two episodes, you know? It didn't have to be 20. I feel like they definitely milked that one a little bit. For Making a Murderer, I already knew the story. I'd already researched it. I'd already kind of gotten to the crux of the issue quite quickly.
I stopped watching it because I was just, like you said, for the reasons that I felt like it was becoming so drawn out. Are the Avery still in prison?
Yeah.
Oh, come on, buddy.
Even I think Brendan's still locked up as well.
That's what I'm saying. Like,
I think that they should maybe let him out, though, because I definitely feel like coerced is a really nice word to use for that confession, and it's been very right.
I think you're really dying in their back by you saying coercion, because I feel like, you know, that kid, he would not be able to pass the first grade, much less be capable of doing that.
But then you think it's just weird how we've gone from, like, you know, Murder, She Wrote, you know, like what? To like Making a Murderer. That's just a crazy cultural shift, right?
I think it's just how our palettes have changed. I think, you know, the whodunit's kind of the suspense was the big part of the hook. I think, you know, if you're dealing with a new demographic and just dealing with just consumers of media in general, it's not enough to just have the flashback where she goes, and then you administered the poison. And then we didn't find it too late. And that's all she has to do. And then the woman just goes, I gave that man the best 10 years of my life for him to cut me out the will. All she has to do is a flashback and they confess. It's like, there's not going to be any evidence. Don't say anything. Your lawyer's not even there yet. But I think what's happened now is that where, you know, TV in general has kind of changed and evolved, you know, because you've got box sets and stuff. I think now, Howard, your whodunits have to come with that kind of stylized violence and that ongoing suspense and what more graphic detail about the gore and these acts, because...
But what's more shocking than it being real life as well? Like, what's
the big... Hook. Yeah, exactly. Now, based on a true story, whenever you see a film based on a true story, you do a little extra, okay. When you're in the cinema, it's mm-hmm. and it gives them so much artistic license as well. But when you talk about true crime, is that normally included in the extremities of like murder, or is true crime like, do you like mafia, sorry about that, the mafia or organized crime kind of thing?
Well, I think I gear towards the murder, the serial killer, the crimes of passion, I think, yeah, more than organized in terms of my particular tastes and my consumption of true crime. But I think, you know, especially what you were saying, Dane, about audiences evolving and us having more robust palates, you know, it's not about just having a chip now. We need it to be triple fried.
Yeah, exactly. With the aioli and the ketchup as well.
Yeah, exactly. And you need to put some parsley on that bad boy. Okay. Like, that's our palate for violence, our palette for excitement is beyond a flashback from Love
and
Jessica.
Sexy violence as well. It's like sexy violence. It's like, he stalked the girl. She was 19 years old and just freshman at college. You know, she doesn't even have a bra in this picture. But what could happen next? Like, you know, flashback to red all of a sudden.
But it's true, though. Like you said, you know, films and stuff that are based on true stories are much more likely to get the time of day from me, because it really does boil down to, like, the things that people do to each other, you know. Of course, you know, we've all seen crimes, like, seen photos. We've all kind of heard the story. Somebody knows somebody who knows somebody who knows somebody that something's happened to. But, you know, I listen to this podcast called Court Junkie, yeah? And she, her name's Gillian, right? And she plays you actual audio from the court, and listening to people and like interrogations and people confessing or people denying it. And when you're listening, it's like, even just the court system and the way that's set up and the way that, you know, a murderer can get off, yeah, because the police forgot to read them a particular right and all these sort of things. I think it all boils down to, forgive me, because I know it's people's lives, but juicy content. Like, I'm in my house and I'm listening and I'm like, oh shit, someone's in her house. This is crazy. But it's like, but this happened to somebody. It's that thrill that, you know, like it's the point of horror movies. It's the point of thrillers.
Exactly,
it's the point.
Yeah, it's the point. Yeah. Is that, and I think that's what you're going to say as well, is that, and also it's, and I think there's an escapism in it. Especially if you're someone who has like a sociological interest in just humans behaving towards each other, like how do you go from harmony to hostility? Sometimes it's a way of being like, you might not be able to conceptualize, like in your own head, like, I can't imagine just going to kill a random I don't know and then having to murder them with a blunt instrument and, you know, hearing someone, your head can't get around it. But there are people that their complex has normalized that, whether it's like, you know, part of their brain being psychotic or having a psychosis, they can normalize that. And it's almost as if, because you're not experiencing it, it's like I said, there's a human fascination with it. It's like, how can someone do that? Like, and I got a theory behind it, is that like, maybe biologically as well, you know, human beings are supposed to be at the apex of us, our evolutionary chain from being like single-celled organisms to now, right? Which we've gone through the stages of being like, you know, whether it's sharks and primates or just, so I think maybe it's coded in our DNA. There's certain elements of a predatory nature that probably allowed us to get to this point of being apex predators within our ecosystem. And sometimes those things kind of switch on, because I guess most other organisms don't really kill for, you know, the sake of, they kill, you know, for the sake of survival, right? Most other animals. Mm-hmm. Human beings are the animals you normally see killing for monetary gain or for emotion, you know, and it just might be a natural darker part of our nature where bloodletting is, or even, you know, socially or culturally, and even though evolution, you know, evolution is a millennial process, there's parts of us where there are times in our society where, even though we look at this stuff as true crime now, there's parts of our society whereby, for example, spousal or domestic violence that could have led to death wouldn't be a crime you get punished for. Yeah. So that's probably contributed to like how, you know, this kind of still continues. Also, I guess we, you know, ritualistically have been involved in bloodletting, whether it was like we used to do bloodletting for medical purposes or people used to do it as rituals to like deities and stuff. And maybe that's still part of our thing, because, you know, the horror film was an interesting one because...
With LinkedIn Jobs, we tap into a network of more than a billion professionals to help you find quality professionals quickly and easily for any role you need. Marketing wizards? Found them.
Software engineers?
Found.
That project manager I could never seem to hire?
And found. LinkedIn Jobs quickly matches your roles with candidates with the right skills and experience. In fact, 86% of small businesses get a qualified candidate within 24 hours. Post your first job for free and get started at linkedin.com/spoken. That's linkedin.com/spoken. Terms and conditions apply.
Tired of ads intruding into your favorite comedy podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Dive into a world of laughs by downloading the Amazon Music app for free, or go to amazon.com/comedyadfree. That's amazon.com/comedyadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
A lot of time it's a part of encouraging abstinence, and it's part of this whole propaganda thing whereby it's like, if you look at horror films, very similar to like true crime depictions where it's normally like a predator stalking a young, attractive woman. For a large part of it, kind of, it has helped to reinforce patriarchy, where it's like, if you're a woman and you go and have sex when you decide by yourself with a guy without being married, then someone can murder you and it's okay because you were the kid that was out in the field having sex. And that's supposed, you know, so you'll be naturally less inclined to indulge in your own independence if you think there's a true threat. So it can be an effective tool in that respect. But I think it's like you said, it's like, I think because you're initially weaned on the embellishment of these things. For example, like, you know, you spoke about like John Wayne Gacy. I feel like was it Ed Gein that used to do the skinning. So yes. Ed Gein is who?
John Wayne Gacy. He killed boys.
He killed boys, right? Yeah.
Yeah, and he's the one that used to dress up as a clown for.
Because John Wayne Gacy is who It is based on, by Stephen King, I think. And Ed Gein is who Buffalo Bill is based on in Silence of the Lambs. I probably heard of those films first before I heard of the killers. Their actual names. And I think sometimes we've had this embellishment of stylized violence and whodunits and like these thrillers and these gory thrillers, and they have allowed our palette to become more broadened to this being this whole true crime thing being sensationalized.
I agree, and I think it's the way you speak about the victims as well is something that really, really like draws me in, because, you know, there's no coincidence in my extremely uneducated opinion, there's no coincidence that, you know, that sex workers, for instance, are the victim of choice for a lot of and it's because, you know, they're the right, and I say that with the biggest bunny ears, type of victim, because it's like their lifestyle does leave them more at risk. And it's like, you know, if you look at from the Yorkshire Ripper to Jack the Ripper, if you look at so many different types of killers, it will be sex workers that they are they're honed in on, because they're not necessarily going to be investigated as much as if it was a lovely.
And also, it led to the whole patriarchal and abstinence of women thing, where it's like, if you're a woman, you can be burnt at the stake, or normally the first victims of like killers in horror films are young, sexually active women, and so maybe that contributes to forming the complex of these killers as well. Is that when they do get to the point where like the world is impure and I need to kill people to purify it, they're going to go to the world of vice normally. Because even if you look at like school massacres and stuff, it's like when you find that these guys have had, you know, been gorging themselves on religious rhetoric and stuff like that, it's like, yeah, but you never go and shoot up a brothel or prostitution or like a child trafficking ring. You never go and shoot up a casino. You never go and shoot up like, you know, a trap house. How come you always end up shooting like a school or something? It's very strange that you could go to the quantum of like criminality, you're never there. So it's always, they always go for these very easy victims. So it's a weird thing. And also, the thing about the victim is such a valid point, because I think normally in the part of when they put together this whole aesthetic of true crime, the victim takes really low status, actually.
This is part of the reason why.
Because even when with the whole Stephen Avery thing, like with Making a Murderer, I'm like, when I first watched it, this is injustice. How could this happen? Brendan didn't do anything. He's too dumb. And then when they were talking about it, it was like they wanted to reopen the case, and then the family were opposing it. And in my head, I'm like, what's wrong with this family? We're trying to get to the truth. But
I've got a question for you. Do you know what the girl's name is who died?
That's what I'm saying. I know her face. But it's even like, I used to do a joke on stage when I used to talk about Oscar Pistorius. And people would be like, you can't do that. It's too soon. And I'd be like, cool. What was his victim's name? And they'd be like, meow. Like even three. But you don't remember, because, and the thing is, it's like, I remember being towards the family, like, why did they not want to get to the bottom of what happened to their daughter? And it's like, maybe listening to the nuances of your child's brutal torture and rape prior to their murder is not something you want to necessarily hear again. In the same way that no one's, you know what I mean? It's like everyone with a sex tape has a parent who also has the internet. Do you know what I mean? So,
you know, I think that like Oscar Pistorius' girlfriend, the name was Reva Steenkamp, but I care about the victims, and I think as well, like, people who do perpetrate these crimes, be it, you know, Oscar Pistorius, be it Peter Sutcliffe, be it Dev in the new ITV drama, that's really, really good, by the way. Like, the killers are the ones who are revered. They're the ones who become superstars.
They're the ones. So it's like even with massacres, that's what I say, not to mention the people that do when they do like the kid with the Georgia Tech kid, they're like, you're not supposed to mention their names because you lionize them. Or you see recently, that kid, Carl Wilson, the kid who did the shooting in America recently, he drove to Wisconsin, yeah.
Yeah, that is so crazy. I find it so mad.
Yinka, have you ever, killed anybody? Yeah. No, that would be an amazing episode. This would be the most downloads we'd ever have if you have and you want to admit it now, but don't admit that. No, I was going to say, have you ever tried to kind of solve a crime, like a true crime thing?
I tried, like there's a missing persons case that I covered in my most recent upload on YouTube. And it's a story of a guy who actually worked on The Voice UK and the TV show. And his name is Terence Woods. And he, I'll give you like a quick overview of his story. So 2 years ago in October, 2018, he went with the Discovery Channel to Idaho in the USA, and they were filming for the new series of Gold Rush, which is in the abandoned mines in a remote part of the state. And the town that they were next to only has like 250 people living there, so it's super, super, super tiny. Everyone's cousins, and they live in a very, very remote place. And he's gone there with like 10 other people, and obviously it's freelance, so he doesn't necessarily know everyone really well. I think he'd met a couple of people doing odd jobs like around. He's originally from New York, but he was living in London. He was there, he was meant to be there for I think 2 weeks. After a few days, he like texted his dad and was like, I'm coming home early. Yeah. His dad's like, why? He never replied. Then one day on the 5th of October, it's 5:30 and they've been filming the whole day. This is the story that these people gave the police here. It's filming. They've stopped filming. This guy is standing there, right, on a mountain or a cliff. Apparently, Terrence drops his radio and runs. And he's never
not runs on the cliff, just runs into the wilderness.
He runs like down a hill or off a cliff. We're not entirely sure, yeah, but he runs. And he runs like down a steep hill, cliffy type thing, onto like the embankment bit, and he goes into the woods. And there's no sign of him again. They never find any scent of him when they bring dogs. They never find any clothing. They don't find a body. They don't find any broken bramble, nothing to indicate that he had ran away, nothing to indicate where he had gone. Obviously, he's in an abandoned mine town. So there are abandoned houses, there are ditches, there are things that have been built but then left over years. And they looked for him for a couple of days. They were like, oh, we can't find him. He just ran away into the woods. Oh, that's it. That's the end of that. And like I spoke to like his dad. I spoke to people who knew him and trying to get like more information out of it. And it just feels like the fishiest thing.
Is he black?
He's black, and everyone else was white.
Yinka, and you say Idaho.
Idaho.
Nah, man, I think we know exactly what happened here.
Like, and it's just like, and in speaking to people who knew him, like people from the UK, people who like I've met, who like obviously the production company, they're still functioning, they're still rocking around producing shows.
I mean, the fact that this has not been really made mainstream media, considering he was involved in the television productor, and on The Voice. Now, if he'd been caught selling drugs, we'd know who he is. Nah, that's a madness.
And Terrence, gone. Like, there's nothing. And I said, but the thing is, even if, yeah, apparently he was being really quiet the day he went missing, according to these random people, like, apparently whatever. But my thing is that even if he ran into the woods, yeah, and, like, passed away, you can't hide your own body.
No. And the thing is, I've known people in television who worked with the guy, and they all... You know, the people I've spoken to are like, they don't understand it. You know, they're like, as in like him being, I think we can all agree, we've met some very unpredictable people in the media world who you would hear some stories about disappearance and kind of go, yeah, kind of not that surprised. But from what I understand, he is not one of those people.
No, yeah. From the people that I've spoken to in the last week or so who knew him, they are like, this is so ridiculous. And even, oh my God,
I want to cite a precedent of an instance of where another Briton went missing in a foreign territory. And when she was reported missing, the Deputy Prime Minister called her parents to console them. So it seems very strange that in a completely English-speaking country with which we are very closely aligned as nations, someone as prolific as a TV presenter could go missing and leave no trace, and no deputy prime minister called then, and none of our officers are sent over there to do a superior investigation to this very small town's investigators. But we did with Madeleine McCann. How is that a case that you have studied?
Yeah, but I think Madeleine, like, you know, God rest her. But I, even when I was watching the documentary on Netflix, it was more like a come and visit Portugal type of show. I feel like
a dark tour.
Yeah. Like Madeleine McCann is just a case that is one of those phenomenons. I think it's one of those cases that I think, oh, because you know, you think of Victoria Kulumbe and you think of, you know,
Tony Ann Byfield.
Do you know what I mean? And you think of these cases where there has
been, baby P.
But yeah, and you think of things where it's like there are children whose names, or even Hannah Foster, who you know, her killer ran away to India and then her parents went and got in, boy. Like, and you think of her, and I think that is money well spent. Like, you actually did your job and you brought that person home or to justice or whatever it may be. And then, you know, you have other cases where, you know, only in 2020 were we going to get somebody saying that they knew where Madeleine was, because this year is the year that aliens are going to come for us. So it's just that thing of, I think it's that case of, you know, the Black Dahlia. I think it's the case of like something that's never, I don't think it's going to be solved. I don't think, you know, like that. It's like, are we really going to?
I don't think it even matters now. I don't think it matters. It's one of these things where I don't think people, the resolution does not come from sort of
finding
It's almost like a political killing, because a lot of people say that's the reason why Moira Henley was still in prison, even though she was like more of an accessory to the crimes. It's like they can't release her for political reasons, but
I think it's important because we would have had Yinka on the show anytime, but you have a really incredible project that we mentioned at the top of the show coming out on Channel 4, and obviously you can watch it live, but obviously on demand, which is what a lot of us do now. I don't know if you want to tell the audience a little bit about it now, and we can discuss it, because I know, Dane, it's important to you too.
So I have teamed up with Channel 4 to tell the story of one of my childhood best friends, because 20 years ago, this week, Damilola Taylor was murdered and he was my neighbour. So I'm kind of going back to where I grew up. I am speaking to people who I knew and loved and played with. I'm trying to investigate, not necessarily his killing and his slaying and the people that did it, but trying to paint a picture of who he was as a person. Because I think when I say the name Damilola Taylor, potentially everybody listening knows exactly who I'm talking about. You know, you probably have a recall to the picture of him half smiling in that burgundy jumper. And that was plastered all over the red tops and all over the news. And I think that there's an inevitability of a victim that comes with him and his story. You know, he moved from Nigeria. He moved to the hell and the arse crack that is Peckham of London. And then we killed him. And that's kind of what has been perpetuated for the last couple of decades. And it's just me revisiting the story and me trying to explain it from a point of view that I'm not sure that a documentary has done about a domestic murder.
Because on that note, do you like feel, and because you did the comparison of Victoria Kimbley versus a Madeleine McCann, because I don't think a lot of people know about Victoria Kimbley and the fact that her and Tony Ann Byfield as well, because one of the very unique aspects of both of those cases that these are, for those people that might not know, these are examples of infanticide to young girls who were killed in a household as a result of ongoing abuse and domestic violence, which wasn't actually done by members of their family. So Victoria Kimbley was not even being looked over by her biological parents.
No, it was like a random auntie.
A random auntie. And, you know, for certain aspects of continental African culture, an auntie doesn't necessarily mean that your mom's sister either. But it's kind of a random thing. I only said that to say this. Do you feel, historically, the story of Damiola has been covered in the same way that, like, James Bulger's case was covered?
This is the thing. It's that I don't want to conflate my grief or my loss with other people's grief and loss. I don't think that one child dying is more important than another child dying. And I don't think that, one story deserves more coverage than the other. What I will say is that I think Damilola Taylor's story stands out the same way that a Sarah Payne, a Holly and Jessica, a Tia Sharp, a James Bulger, the way these cases stand out, because they are particularly horrific, be it the age and of the victim or the nature of them.
And the age of the perpetrators in some cases as well.
And the age, so the age of the perpetrators in Dami's case. I think that, you know, I'm not saying that in the last 20 years I wanted to be on this morning couch every November. I'm not saying that, you know, I would be willing and able to give interviews to that Donald McIntyre every time he wants to do a crime that should be written on CSI or whatever it may be, the Crime and Investigation Network. What I am saying is that I'm not convinced that Dami's story of him being a child, of him existing and being a human being before he was killed, has been pushed to the mainstream. I think that enough time has passed for there to be enough distance and people's lives to be different now than they were 20 years ago to really put in perspective that this happened. But, you know, I know so many kind of domestic crimes involving children that receive nationwide attention long after they've happened because of, and I don't know, Dami's hasn't. It's just, he came from Nigeria, the people in Peckham killed him, and boy, don't go there. And then they continue.
Well, and it comes down to this, really, in some respects, the attitudes and racism that when it happened at the time, I think a lot of people, in the mainstream conscious of this country would have thought that we weren't very racist still, or not as racist as we, I'm saying Dane, I can see Dane's face.
It's definitely what Yinka was saying as well, is that, like, we'd say that, you know, the fact that there was an outpouring of grief, but it's like Yinka said, in the same way that we kind of lionize killers in some instances, it's almost as if we kind of, I don't know what's the word I'm looking for. Well, it's like martyrdom. It's like he more died for a story, more for the sake of a story or a narrative rather than looking at his individual life. Because if you look at like the kid, Rhys James, he was yeah. shot, and then the one of the kids that shot him, his mother hid the gun for him. And again, it's like there didn't seem to be like a larger condemnation of any culture within that particular area of Merseyside, or, you know, considering he was shot, there was no look at like urban youth violence amongst working class white men in the same way that, like, you know, someone gets killed on North Peckham Estate.
Well, they demolished the whole estate.
There you go.
And they were going to knock it down anyway, but
then they could knock it down and justify displacing the former residents, though.
Yeah. Oh, they called it decanting.
like your bottle of Cavassier.
like I'm a wine. Right?
Yeah, that's great.
It's just this sort of thing of, you know, I feel like it's so weird to be in this position, because obviously I'm in an industry, I work in a job that is forward facing and it's in the public domain. So I genuinely don't think that there's anybody who's more qualified to tell this story than I am, because A, I have a voice and I'm actually able to speak publicly, but B, it's my life.
Yeah,
it's actually what happened to me. So in it is, you know, it's my sister, it's my childhood best friend, it's people that I grew up with, and I get to meet Grammy's dad for the first time, because when he passed away, we were told under no uncertain terms to leave his family alone, and we weren't allowed to go to the funeral. So it's like
who told you that?
The police and the community support people who were rocking around. So it was just like a lot of, it was very therapeutic to do it. And my first film for Channel 4, it was a baptism of fire, like, wow. But it was definitely something that I hope that people watch it, and I hope that people can just see it for what it is, because I'm not the sort of person that, like, I find someone like you really brave, Dane, like the way that you can like say what you mean and it's like, this is what I said. Whereas with me, I'm like, oh, I don't want to accuse people of stuff. I don't want to. So the way that I kind of try to be assertive is just by presenting people with my version of the truth, presenting people with the facts of what happened. And if you can't draw the conclusion that it is, if you can't do 1 + 1 and it equals 2, then that's a personal problem.
Yeah. I mean, yeah. And I think that's, I guess, why I have that kind of breadth to be able to say what I want, because I guess I'm always trying to approach everything from an artistic perspective. So I know it's always open to subjective interpretation. And if that conclusion isn't something that someone likes, not really my problem. It's more about evoking the emotion or the discussion in the first place. So I guess it's a way of approaching it. But that can be very different when you are dealing with a phenomenon that has a lot, that, you know, depends on a lot of historical and factual aspects. So it's very different because, you know, what you're talking about involves dates and names. And in, you know, this case, you know, people who lost their lives. So there has to be a lot more apprehension in terms of how you approach it. So far as, like, definitely we know there's a fascination with true crime. Do you think there are any indicators where this fascination can become unhealthy? You know, obviously, because, like I said, there's a very lot more of a graphic nature to when people discuss true crime. Is there a problem that we become desensitized? Is there, you know, the whole thing of copycat killings? Can it be influential for that, do you think?
I think when it comes to like true crime in general, of course, there's a thin line between being fascinated and being obsessed. And I do think that as a world, as a generation, I do think that we are desensitized. You know, if you go online, you could see somebody being killed on Twitter with no trigger warning. The videos of especially black bodies and bodies of color being slain, being abused, especially now with like NSARS that's trending about Nigeria and the brutality that's going on there. At any given moment, you could be subject to images that, you know, will really, really affect you. And let's not forget the fact that George Floyd was killed in front of all of us. And I didn't mean to watch that video. You know, even if we take it, Nipsey Hussle was killed in front of all of us. I didn't mean to watch that video. XXXTentacion, he was shot and it was streamed live on bloody Facebook. I didn't mean to watch his video.
It's even like we found out before his family did.
Yeah, I mean, it was before it registered. It's that thing of definitely, I think that there is a thin line between things being a curiosity and things being an interest to you versus, you know, the insatiable need for blood, so to speak. I think for me personally, my fascination with true crime, it doesn't actually go hand in hand with the type of content and films that I'm making. It's like the violence that I've experienced in my life, you know, with my best friend being killed when he was 10 years old, that didn't trigger me to wanting to fight true crime. And I'm not Batman. Like I'm not, it didn't like ignite this fire in me to want to right the wrongs of the world. It's kind of like I can compartmentalize and be like, I don't want to think about the people that I know who have died. I am from Peckham, and you know, not to say that the way we've been tarred and feathered is completely accurate, but I think it was a violent place, and I actually existed during the time when Blue Story
so
was
I
real.
Tell people, and I was in SE13, you know, so.
SE15, we could have got each other.
That being said, like, I did go down by North Peckham Estate because I wanted it to be very clear that I am not about the girl youth life.
Yeah, it says, but that it was real.
At the time, that was one of the parts of the story that I was like, how is this even happening on the estate? Because normally it's us that are there. So, yeah.
But my fascination with true crime is outside of that. That's why I try to look at like the crazy things people do to each other. Maybe try and understand the violent place that we live in, the violent place in which I grew up and the trauma that, and I will say it's trauma that a lot of us experienced on council flats. Something like 1 in 3 kids grow up in social housing. So the story that I'm telling for Dan Malone, The Boy Next Door for Channel 4 is not a tale that is isolated. Yeah. You know,
it's not obscure, is it? It's not an obscure thing.
No, but I just think
that's what I wanted to ask as well, because you know, like with true crime, the reason why, because we'd mentioned earlier about like chronicling or, you know, true crime from the perspective of music and stuff. Mm-hmm. Obviously, I feel like, you know, as you said, you know, black trauma and our exposure to true crime is a massively normalized thing. Like, you know, you witnessed a police officer killing a civilian in broad daylight in a supposed civilized Western society. You have someone like Terrence Wood going to a part of America which is known for being distinctly quite racist and disappearing. You know, you look at stuff like, you know, you talk about sex workers being on the front line. You know, there was a police officer called Daniel Holtzclaw, who I think is now doing over 200 years because he raped up to like over 30 black women. And no one really cared and raped and murdered.
You can look at the cases of like Anthony Walker and you look at Stephen Lawrence.
These are examples of truth. Or like the fact that like it could be a part of your impetus to like for the work you do is that you want to exist as an alternative whereby my experience of trauma has not led to me to have been desensitized to violence or committing trauma on other people. But before this shit, you could kill a black 10-year-old in America or a place like Idaho in the 60s. Or a 14-year-old kid, or in the case of Emmett Till.
Yeah, I did it. You'd have
friends from like at 14. You watch some, and not only that, no justice. Not even just no justice. The law enforcement institution that exists to protect you from your exposure to these crimes is working adroitly with the people that are committing these acts. So, how much? And I know we haven't got a lot of time, but like, do you think there's a lot of time apportioned to just at least describing the trauma that black people experience as true crime?
Well, that's why I'm kind of passionate about what I want to do and the way I want to tell my stories and other people's stories, because ultimately I actually think that people are very desensitized to the mutilation and the abuse of black bodies. And I don't even say that in a general way. Like the reason why I wanted to start with Dami is obviously it means a lot to me and I want to do his family and my family proud. I also want people to know that he's a human being. Like it's like that. Our story is not a black
people
story.
People talk about like he's a fucking foal. Like, you know what I mean? Like Bambi's mum or something.
And this is it. And it's like, but no, that's my friend who I saw on the day that he died and he was fine. Like he was taken. It wasn't inevitability. He wasn't wandering the streets alone with no one who loved him. Like, it's not that. And I think that it's just trying to change the narrative. Like, especially when I started to get into true crime, when I started to produce, because I've only been doing it for like a year, like actually producing my own content, but I've been consuming it for most of my life. And I realized it's an old white man's world. Like, the gatekeeping is insane. Like, when you put the Crime and Investigation Network on, when you watch these shows, it is the same old dude hosting these shows over and over again. And he's speaking about, you know, like
he speaks as if he's reading from an audiobook.
Yeah, and it's like, no. Yeah. This is real. So it's like, I want to put a human face to these stories. I want to make sure that our stories are given the same agency, the same care, the
and
same
we describe it as a true crime, not a fucking article in Black History Month for a little snippet of this was a journey. And then Martin Luther King and everything, like these sepia-toned flashbacks, we have been victims of true crime. And it's important for people to know about that shit. Sorry,
well, I imagine this will be one of the first true crime projects that you do on TV, and I'm sure there'll be many more, Yinka. Yeah. You got loads lined up, I assume.
I'm going to keep doing the YouTube stuff. I think people kind of know that it's what I want to do now. So hopefully there's definitely more to come, and hopefully you'll see me before I'm 55. My own show on the crime investigation.
Well, I've watched the film, and I have to tell you, listeners, go and find it. I was just amazed by how I don't find true crime particularly emotional, or kind of, you know, I don't call it a true crime thing, really. I think it's just a really, really beautiful film. Yinka makes you connect with the subject in a way that I don't know if anyone has done before. So
it needs to be done, because, you know, I just want to say it's great and commendable what you've done as well, because hopefully, or if not, so could you tell us if there's any focus or any journalistic focus other than yourself on true crime when the victims are Black people, the diaspora?
No, not that I know of. Not that I've I assume that things exist as a huge world. But
well, it pleases me to see the conception of that come from yourself. So we're at ground zero when it begins, which is amazing. And I guess bring this back to the end of the episode. So yeah, other than the documentary, or actually just let us know, we can find you the details of the documentary and also the YouTube channel and stuff, so that people can start doing some real true crime research.
Yeah, so the documentary is of course going to be on Channel 4 this week, downloaded The Boy Next Door, but you can find it on all four as well after Thursday, I think. And yeah, and the YouTube is just Yinka Bikini. It's called The Anniversary Cartel, True Crime Stories on the Anniversary that have been happening. And whilst it is like a UK true crime channel, I do try to focus on telling the stories of people of colour, both here and throughout the world. Just trying to give light to stories that don't necessarily get the right amount of attention, in my opinion.
Cool, amazing. And I hope that we've been able to enhance that as well, Yinka. So, Yinka, I know you work very hard, and so need some rest, because you... for those also who don't know, other than you, you can also find Yinka on Capital Extra with Shane Noah. Mm-hmm. So it's doing the morning show, so please do check that out as well. And also check out her TED Talk, TED Talk X, which was recorded in Peckham as well. So, yeah, lots of content. Yinka, thank you so much for taking the time to come on the podcast and ask the question. Yeah, get some rest. Lord knows you've earned it.
Thank you for having me, Dan.
My pleasure. Have a wonderful day.
Yinka, good luck. We'll see you again soon.
Yes, hopefully. Thank you. I really appreciate that.
You've been listening to Dane Baptiste Questions Everything, hosted by Dane Baptiste. For more from Dane, go to danebaptiste.co.uk or follow him on Twitter at DaneBapTweets or Instagram at DaneSnapTeast. Our guest was Yinka Bikini. You can follow Yinka on Twitter and Instagram at Yinka Bikini. The show is produced by me, Howard Cohen. Follow me on Twitter and Instagram at The Howard Cohen. The show is mixed and mastered by Audio Culture. You can follow Audio Culture on Instagram at We Are Audio Culture. Please rate and review the show on Apple Podcasts or wherever you listen to us. You can find us on Twitter and Instagram at DBQE Podcast. Thanks to Polly, Gelly and the Acast team for all their support. Thanks for listening, guys. And remember, question everything.
Tired of ads intruding into your favorite comedy podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Dive into a world of laughs by downloading the Amazon Music app for free, or go to amazon.com/comedyadfree. That's amazon.com/comedyadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.